Well, first of all, we're doing The Handmaid's Tale this week. And if you're not familiar with the overall plot of the show, it's pretty heavy. And Krista, do you have a overall synopsis?
According to Wikipedia, again, please donate when you can. It says, quote, "The Handmaid's Tale is a dystopian television series based on a 1985 novel of the same name. The plot features a dystopia following a second American Civil War where a totalitarian society subjects fertile women called handmaids to childbearing slavery."
Given that synopsis, this series and this episode has a number of things that you would expect based on hearing that, and this podcast will discuss them, and specifically an instance of sexual assault. So just be mindful of that, and if you want to take this week off, we won't hold that against you.
Absolutely.
So, Krista, let me ask you, what is your familiarity with this show? Have you heard of it? Have you heard what it's about? I'm sure you have, but I would like to hear your background with it.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for asking. I have heard of it. I think most people have. It's, won a ton of awards. It is usually well weighted by its audience. They're very excited for new seasons to come out. I have personally not watched it before, although my parents have, although even when I shared with them that this would be the episode that we were talking about this week, they said that it was very heavy and maybe to take it just one episode at a time, which I could see why after watching it. I did know that it was a dark show. I knew it was about a, dystopia, and there was something about a control of women. And I knew that Elizabeth Moss and I think Alexis Bledel, who was actually not in this episode, was in it. But that's pretty much the extent of my knowledge. What about you?
Yeah, I'm not sure when this initially started airing, but I feel like it synced up with a lot of political turmoil in reality. So a lot of people I know who have talked about it, or even just reading sort of the commentary, it would make analogies between developments in our political landscape and things going on the show, and some things I've read of it. Maybe that's not entirely a good take, or maybe a superficial one. That being said, I have heard a lot about this show. I know a lot of coworkers who have watched it. I even know some friends or colleagues who have stopped watching it. I'm not sure if it's because of the content of the show or the quality. Again, I'll just say I've only seen this episode, so that's my background with it.
Yeah. Let's jump in.
Let's jump right in.
I'm gonna do a quick, synopsis, or I'm gonna do the synopsis, and then I have some, as always, I have some notes for the end. So, opening scene.
I'm sorry, not to cut you off.
Oh, no, that's okay.
Can you remind the audience of the title of the episode,
Yes.
the air date,
Yep.
and yeah.
Thank you. I'm apparently off my game, folks. We are watching season 3, episode 11. It is titled Liars, and it aired on July 31st, 2019. And David, to answer kind of a question you posed earlier, this show originally aired like the first season in April 2017. So,
Okay, so
yeah,
yeah.
very aligns with a lot of political turmoil. Again, folks, I feel like every single week my voice is off, so whenever my voice is like fully back and up and running, everyone's gonna be more shocked by that than my raspy voice. But anyways, yes.
Similarly, I accidentally breathed in some eyeglass cleaner while I was cleaning my glasses, so I don't
I
know
heard
if
that.
that's going to have go ahead.
I was gonna say I heard that eliminates coronavirus from your
Yeah,
body, so.
I think the president of Gilead said that.
All right, let's jump into this plot. So the opening scene is confusing. And I think this show at first, I was very confused at what was going, what was happening in the kind of previously on piece.
Yeah. It's a lot in there. It was in there.
Right. Yeah. And the biggest thing I took from that was that they're doing some sort of smuggling operation.
Yeah.
Something's going to be smuggled. What we learn is it's 52 children.
Yeah, and we learned that through... there's a lot of information that's dumped in this, which is helpful for us, but I guess there's a network of communication, and messages are communicated via the transportation of muffins and...
Yeah.
What was that? Bagels? I guess bagels are no and muffins are yes.
I was so confused, so I'm glad that you caught on to that. So... That makes more sense.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess throughout the messages, they figure we can smuggle a couple of people in exchange for 52 children. And it's not clear to me who is getting those children. Maybe the Canadians? Yeah. So,
yeah, that's what I came to understand.
Yeah. So, I guess right off the bat, Canada is, and similar to the days of slavery, Canada is the free zone. For Americans to enter into. Do you want to go ahead with the plot?
No. So in this first opening scene, there's a woman named Eleanor, and she right away is about to kill this war criminal who is like the owner of the house that Elizabeth Moss's character, June, is the a maid of. And I don't know if Eleanor also is a maid there. Not sure. Not doesn't matter. But basically, she like walks in and there is a gun. I mean, this woman has a gun to his head. Very intense. And then June, I'm going to try to use the character's name. So June de-escalates the situation. She, you know, says, hey, like, we have a plan. He's going to help us. We're going to help him escape and flee. But we're also going to save 52 children as well. And it's a really intense scene, and the biggest thing, one thing that I took away from that was, like, I kind of felt like a scene that an episode should end on, not start it.
Yeah, I got that vibe, too. And one thing I'll touch on, well, I'll just go ahead and say it now. I felt like, not only did this look like a movie, but there was so much in here that I felt like we were witnessing maybe the second act or the third act of a movie. If you were to ask me what kinds of things would you want in either a miniseries or a film of The Handmaid's Tale, this hit on, I mean, but just based on what little I know, this hit on so many of those things. You get to see them have a commander at their mercy. Worth mentioning too, June does say here, I know you want to kill him. I want to kill him too.
Yeah.
The other character saying it's his fault this whole thing's happening. It's his fault, you know, that you've been raped. And she says, yeah. June says, yeah, that's true, but it's also our fault, which I thought was interesting. I don't know what exactly that's in reference to, perhaps just not being free. But yeah, as Krista, as you mentioned, she does reiterate that he's going to be very useful to them.
Yeah, and overall, I think she just, like I said, June de-escalates the situation, and then it cuts to June and this old man, you know, just having a drink, it looks like. They're talking next steps. Things were overlooked, and it really sounds like he was like a key player in the Second Civil War.
Worth mentioning, this commander, I don't have his name, but he is played by Bradley Whitford. June, of course, is played by Elizabeth Moss, so this is a West Wing reunion.
Is that really played by Bradley Whitford?
Yeah, I looked it up.
Shut up!
I was like, that guy kind of looks like Bradley Whitford, and I looked it up, and it really is him.
I have to look this up. I apologize because oh my God, I knew he looked familiar.
Yeah.
This is bananas.
He did not look like that in the West Wing. He was clean shaven, but a lot of people know him from Get Out, in which he has that similar look. He has the beard. He's very distinguished.
And not to foreshadow, but he also was in a later episode of Law & Order SVU where he's clean shaven. So, anyways, I'm honestly shocked right now that I didn't catch that because I have a lot to say about the cast later on.
It's kind of an understated performance, too.
Right.
He gives, like, some bigger ones and other things he's in.
Yeah. So, that's kind of the wrap of that scene. And then we cut to two women talking about getting Nicole back, which we learn is the one woman who I believe is Mrs. Waterford's daughter. Apparently there's some government negotiations going on, unclear. And then what presumably is her husband picks her up. Looks like they're in a nicer building. It's very different than where we are with June and Bradley Whitford. I don't know his name, so I'm just going to call him that. For this part is very insignificant because then we go flip back to June. And I will say the one thing about this show is it really stays on the same set of characters. Like, there's two sets of characters, at least in this episode, and they go back and forth, and it makes it so easy to understand. So
much easier than Nashville and All American.
All American was definitely the hardest. There was so many characters. And I'm sure there's more other characters in this show. But I think this episode, for whatever reason, just kind of goes between these players.
We got lucky.
Yes.
I did see that the book is sort of structured where there are a few different stories going on, and it's like the something tale, this tale. So it has some different points of view. Yeah.
Okay.
The first book, at least. Yeah. The original.
Interesting. So, yeah, we go into like what would be kind of the third scene where June is talking with some other women. Basically, she's like summoned into this like back room with some other, I would assume, maids, handmaids, and they tell her...
Yeah, Martha's.
Martha's, yes, thank you. They tell her to cut the plants. They're like, you gotta stop this. And they're kind of going back and forth about saving these kids. It's clearly a very dangerous plan. And it almost feels like there's maybe some different, like, rebel organizations competing underground. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, they come to a deal and they support her plan. But they also are kind of like, we'll support it, but like, also if you get in trouble, like, you're on your own type thing.
That's on you. And she even expresses some self-doubt herself in the form of a narrated piece. I think at one point she's looking at some fruit or something and she's thinking, okay, 52 kids, 10 seats. How does the math work on that?
Yeah. Yeah. Because they're going on, at this point, trucks. And that's not very important, right. But it plays into it. So then again, we switch back to the Waterfords. Again, it seems like this is a very rich couple. Like I said, they were in a super nice hotel. They're driving a car.
Nice car, yeah.
And they are driving down some very rural back roads. They make this comment about the Americans and their devotion to the cause. Mm-hmm. Didn't quite get that. But they also look out and they make another comment that stuck out to me, which was how this place used to just be full of rusty factories. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about that for a moment because that is a piece of imagery that hits a lot for me.
Sure.
Because I think of cities that I love a lot. And I call them underdog cities, but it's kind of, what's the word? It's like post-industrial cities that...
Yeah,
are on the rise again, but it's taken a while. I like cities like that, and it kind of made me dislike these people because I'm like, wait a minute, that's my city. Those are my cities that you're like so glad they're gone, you know? Like, that was like the first indication for me that I was like, I don't like these people.
Worth mentioning, I think it was in this scene, or it was maybe because there were several scenes of them driving.
Yes,
but,
I know what you're gonna say.
They're listening to the radio, some music, and as the song fades out, it says, you know, you are now listening to Radio Free America, and he turns it off immediately. Mm-hmm. So at first I'm thinking, oh, does he not want her to know? But I don't get the sense that that is what's happening.
Yeah.
But just an interesting little bit of world building, right? I think they say, you're listening to Radio Free America, broadcasting from the Great White North, something along those lines.
So interesting. And then he basically lets her drive, which is made clear that
It's against the rules.
And then they show up at like this like farm home. And I don't know if you caught how this family plays in. No idea who they are.
No, okay. I don't know.
And they don't really play an important role, to be honest.
Not in what we've seen.
Their storyline at all.
No.
So... cut back to the June's house, or the house she's working in, I should say. It's like the morning, they're preparing some breakfast, and one of the maids says like, oh, you know, somebody didn't eat whatever. Again, Bradley Whitford, it's worth thinking. And June's like, wait, what? So she goes upstairs and his office is a disaster. There is shredded paper everywhere. Things are disheveled. And there is a notebook on the desk and on it is written the word sorry. And she's pissed. She starts going through the stuff that's remaining. She finds like a phone, which I don't know where it's connected to. And she's upset. Another staff person comes in and is like, we have to stop all this planning. June wants to figure out another way. And this is where, for me, I really learned that June's a threat. Like, she is a dangerous person to be associated with, to be involved with. Clearly, she's, you know, fighting whatever regime is in power. But people who are a part of her world might not be there for a long time.
They know what's at risk.
Yes.
I want to highlight a piece of dialogue from earlier in this episode when she is talking to Bradley Whitford's character and she makes a comment. Can you imagine if you actually end up being a hero in
yes.
this? So she knows that she's using him, but I part of her makes it known that she recognizes that there is a redemptive arc, or at least an ironic one, right? It's almost like a taunt to him, right? Because he needs her help and she needs his help, but she is making it known that he is responsible for this, and anything that happens is just ironic. He's not altruistic, and I thought that was an interesting piece of dialogue, and it makes me curious about their relationship.
I agree. I don't know what their relationship is at all, and we don't really find out a ton of it through this
episode. Not a whole lot of, I think I said earlier that there is a lot of information that's dumped, but I don't know. As far as exposition, I don't feel like it rehashes a whole lot. I mean, I wouldn't know because I haven't seen anything else, but I described to Krista off air that there's more vibes than plot. Although you are doing a wonderful job summarizing this. As I was watching it, though, I don't know that I was so immersed in the plot, but I was more so thinking about how it made me feel and what I was experiencing visually, sonically, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And I felt similarly at many different points. So we're back to the Waterfords. They like eat dinner. I don't know. It doesn't even matter. They eat dinner and they end up out back in the woods. And they're talking about the past and the wife is, I should mention there, it does sound like they're on a journey to get their daughter back, that this trip is a part of that, because that plays into a role later. And I just want to make that clear, but nonetheless,
I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Did you think that she was a handmaid? Cause I know her dress was like kind of traditional. It wasn't like the iconic red thing, but it was kind of along those lines maybe, because we do see other women that are not dressed as modestly and things like that. So,
yeah, I got the vibe she wasn't, that she was clearly connected to somebody who was of higher power.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So she talks about the past and she starts to talk about, you know, their life in, I believe, maybe like New York City or maybe it was DC. I don't remember. But she was a writer and she goes, how could you have taken that away from me?
That's right.
And he goes, I didn't know how much it would cost you.
Mm-hmm. That's right. She mentions, I remember I wrote my first book right over there.
Yeah.
Things like that. Yeah.
Clearly they're high up in the government in DC. And he kind of says like, oh, I wish I could give it up. Or I wish I would. If I could, I would give this all up to watch our daughter grow up.
Then, that's right. That line stood out to me too.
Then they go back into this house and sleep. And they're sleeping in different beds. And I want to point out, up until this point, haven't even touched each other.
Yeah.
Not a whole handhold. And that's okay. But then they're sleeping in different beds. And then they, like, reach out and, like, hold hands, kind of. And then he comes over to her bed, and it's assumed that they have sex.
Yeah, or we're intimate in some way.
Right.
Even, maybe even just holding each other. But, yeah. Which is definitely, it's a departure from what we expected in the last few.
But like, yeah. Very weird scene.
Yeah, no, for sure. That's definitely one of those vibes. And it's like, I wonder why. And I wonder if it's just something between them, or if it's maybe some sort of overall cultural force that has driven them apart, or maybe like the whole nature of intimacy is different because of this society. I don't know, but I am curious.
That's what I'm thinking. Is my assumption is that there's probably been some infidelity, which is not seen as infidelity, but yeah. Let's take a quick pause and let me get a new Zoom link. Let's, apparently.
Hear from our sponsor.
So scene switch. We're back at June's house that she's living at. And guess who shows back up? But Bradley Whitford.
Bradley Whitford.
Apparently, he doesn't have clearance to leave or have any of his business leave.
Mm.
He gives her some news. I'm confused what it is. And then she says, you need to bring me into the city. And then the music changes. Did you catch that?
Yeah, yeah. It was a whole different mood shift.
So she goes to this, like, at first I'm thinking it's like a hotel. That's kind of what the outside looks like. But it's an underground bar is where she ends up.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention her wardrobe in this.
Yes, she's out of her handmade Martha's outfit. And she is in a black dress and some heels, which I've noticed almost all the women wear heels, I think, when they're not in Martha's. I don't know what Martha's.
There's a point made about that.
And so she sits down at the bar. She gets a drink. She's presumably trying to talk to the bartender, who is a contact of her friend, and to talk about how to still put this plan in motion to smuggle these kids out. Basically, there's two pieces here that I want to talk about. The first one is, I'm going to finish this bartender chat, which is, she says, you know, to help me smuggle this, I can give you money. And he's like, there's no money that's worth this. And she goes, I have a house full of art.
Yeah, I have a house full of Picassos, Rembrandts, she mentions a few others. Yeah. Yeah.
Very Nazi Germany.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Art thievery and things like that. Yeah, and he recognizes, okay, yeah, that commander stole all the art or something. And she says, yeah, it's like the MoMA in there, Museum of Modern Art, which, is that what it stands for, Museum of Modern Art?
Because, I don't know. That sounds right.
All right.
Anything else before I talk about the other half of the scene?
I'll just say, I'll get into this later. Okay. This is more of a recommendation than plot.
So as she's sitting at the bar, also, folks, gonna laugh a little bit here because I get uncomfortable and that's what I do. No way am I laughing at what I'm about to say. But there's another woman sitting at the bar, and mm-hmm. June kind of doesn't fully acknowledge her, but like sees her, like acknowledges her, like this woman is sitting at the bar. And then she talks to the bartender, and these men approach her, and they basically like sexually assault her. I don't know to what extent, it doesn't matter, but you know see her, some of her clothes come off, and then they come back. And I think to me this was one of the scariest moments of the show, because it's this moment where you can't help and no one's helping you, and that is so terrifying.
Right, it's the whole culture. I mean, even if June wanted to help her, right, what recourse does she have?
And just to take this a step further, as you all know, everyone that's listened to this, I am deeply obsessed with true crime. And, you know, there's this fear that's instilled in me that when I need help, like if I was about to be kidnapped, that no one would help me. And I think it mostly stems back to a case where a teenage girl was like kidnapped in a parking lot in broad daylight, and she was screaming and nobody did anything. So I think that fear was just so like large for me in that moment. Very intense, but a literal just thing that's happening in the corner of the show, which is like, I think says more about the show and it probably what happens all the time. But since we only watched one episode, We only saw it like in the background, which is just horrific. So June's done her business and she's about to leave, and then somebody recognizes her. She turns around and
it's someone we recognize.
It's Detective Elliot Stabler.
It's Detective Stabler, yeah.
Did not know he was in the show. I love Law & Order SVU. I had it on yeah. today. That caught me by surprise. Clearly June's...
Very upsetting.
Very upsetting, and I want to talk about why. Yeah. And we'll talk about that at the end. But he's like, I want to talk to you. She clearly isn't super happy. They go into, looks like a hotel room, his hotel room, maybe it's his apartment, unsure. And he is like, where's your master? And she gets out of it by making up this lie that he likes that she comes here and is, you know, maybe is with other men.
Because he tries to press on her, like, oh, he is in one of these rooms, where is he?
Yeah.
And then, yeah, as you said, she even says, like, I know you all have your kinks and such. So.
Yeah.
And to him, I guess that does make sense, yeah.
Yeah, and he's down for it as well. He's ready, he's makes it pretty clear, like, hey, this is gonna happen, and, you know.
Yeah, go into this room and whatnot.
And there's a bed, so... at this point, she knows she's about to be raped, and she disassociates.
Yeah, in the voiceover, she says, I try to treat it like it's work, or
I've been here before.
I've been here before was the line that stuck out to me.
I thought this was a really, like, a good shot in that sense. Like, I thought the way it was, how the voiceover was played with June really did make you feel like you were in her head. I thought it was
absolutely
well done.
And I just felt so, you know.
Yeah,
I felt bad.
You're scared. It's definitely upsetting.
I want to highlight just one thing, since you had mentioned the wardrobe earlier. I think as she's starting to, you know, for lack of a better word, prepare for this, he tells her, no, leave your shoes on.
Yeah.
And it has a number of other demands, right, on, you know.
Yeah.
Not to get too detailed, but the shoes thing in particular was interesting to me, I think, symbolically, because maybe in his head he wants to disassociate it from this sort of reality we're in which she's a handmaid and that's her role. And maybe in his mind it was like perhaps... you know, even though he obviously benefits from this, a throwback to maybe a before time, right?
Yeah.
Where if you met someone at a bar like that, it was a mutual thing or an enjoyable thing.
Consensual.
Consensual, yeah. Because, you know, no matter how this went down, even if he wasn't telling her what to do and whatnot, this is not a consensual encounter.
Absolutely.
It could never be. But,
right.
Yeah.
So she's disassociating, and then all of a sudden, she decides to fight back. And they fight, they tussle, they, you know, there's pushing, every type of fighting. I mean, it's a fight.
Yeah, I'll say, I didn't know the extent to which there is, like, fighting in the show, but she gives him several, like, a couple at least, kicks in the face that was like, whoa, I don't think, like, an average person could pull that off.
She's clearly, like, prepared
is, but
for this
prepared,
on some
yeah.
level. And then she stabs him with a pen repeatedly.
Pen.
And kills
him. Did you?
Well, doesn't kill him. She finishes this murder with something else in the room. And she's basically
Like almost trauma. Like a statuette, blunt force trauma, right before... as she's, like, winding up to give him the final blow, he says, my children, right? To try to appeal to her.
Unbelievable.
You know, a number of things, and doesn't really miss a beat.
Yeah.
Hits him right in the head, kills him. I would be really curious to know what that little statuette was, if there's anything poetic about that. Definitely the pen killing him is poetic in my mind, right? Because maybe as a stand-in for Margaret Atwood herself, right? The way people might think about this show or that book as you know, the old adage, the pen is mightier than the sword.
Yeah, absolutely. And then she kind of just sits on the ground. Clearly, she's in shock. I mean, I don't know if she's if she's ever killed somebody. I don't want to use the word murder, but killed anybody up until this point, but she's in shock until housekeeping shows up, presumably the next morning, and it's somebody she knows who comes in and helps her escape.
Yeah, and this is where networks and solidarity really come into place, or come into play, yes. Right? Because we see they have access to the laundry. They have access to an incinerator because of, you know, their subservient roles, but nonetheless, they utilize them. They incinerate his body in a furnace. No one would ever know. They wash the sheets in a very loud and very shaky industrial washing machine. And I thought the shot sort of lingering on that was very interesting because these are tools of domesticity.
Yeah.
But they are using them to their advantage. Can I just give a shout out right now? I know this is maybe a little ahead of ourselves, but I thought the directing was so good in this that I looked up, I noticed her name on the end credits. So I looked her up. My apologies if I'm pronouncing this wrong, but Denise Gamze Ergüven, a Turkish French director. She's fantastic, and I would be really curious, or I'd be really interested in watching.
Yeah.
I know she has a few films. It looks like she's directed maybe some other, she's other episodes of The Handmaid's Tale and another series, Perry Mason. But I thought her direction was fantastic.
I agree.
I think this is the first time we've mentioned
a
director in a show. So, I mean, to just give you an idea of.
Yeah.
How cinematic this was and how really well shot it was.
Yeah. And going back to the scene, the one thing, again, true crime Krista coming in here, we see her escape.
TCK.
We see her escape. And then another scene is when they do the cleaning and ultimately incinerate his body. But between those scenes, the only thing that was going through my head is she left her shoes and her coat there. And isn't that evidence? Which is me being a true crime person. But also I was like, is that going to play in maybe later on? They find their, I don't know. Like, I don't know what the investigative bodies are in this dystopia. Like, you know, but it just, that was where I went with that. And I just wanted to share that.
Can I tell you
a
thought that I had along the same lines? Yours is definitely more constructive. But as they were putting his body in the incinerator, I thought, because his head's kind of sticking out, I thought, okay, we're going to see them use some sort of poker to get his body in. But they just closed the door, and I was wondering,
I felt like they were, like, almost like fully went in. I was like, isn't that hot?
Yeah, they got kind of close. Enough, but they didn't get in. Good for them. But I wonder if his head's not going to burn, or if they're going to wait for the body to mostly burn and then push his head in later. But
so interesting.
I might actually, that's actually really gross. I don't know. But
so final scene, well, no. Second to final scene. Final scene for the Waterfords is they meet at they're at an abandoned gas station in this rural area. And presumably, I've been saying presumably a lot tonight, and I apologize for that.
We don't know.
But it's, they're going to be meeting up with somebody who can help with these maybe backdoor negotiations to get their daughter back. Okay, fine. This guy shows up in a car. They kind of exchange, you know, some words and say, hey, what's up? No. But they're like, he's like, hey, come up here up the road. I know a safer space. And they go on this like kind of long drive. And at one point, they both kind of comment on the drive, but it's more like the guy, the Commander Waterford, saying, like, you trust me? Do you trust this? And she says, yeah. So they get out to this secluded spot, and all of a sudden, he says, you're in Canada, and we're going to arrest you on war crimes. And all these, like, agents.
Armored tanks and trucks and things like that. Men in camo.
Right.
Guns.
And you separate the couple. This couple kind of says a couple things to each other. put him in the back of the vehicles. They say all the things he's being arrested for, these war crimes, and, you know. But I notice, one thing I notice in the scene is that some of those shoulders, oh my gosh, some of those soldiers were wearing American flags on them. So there must be, like...
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, there must be some sort of, like, U.S. government...
Yeah, like a government in exile
entity.
Type thing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
That still exists. But very intense scene. Did not see that coming. Yeah, and then we switch back. We switch back again to June. This is where you see the incineration cleaning. And then she's back at the house with Lawrence. Oh, that's his name. That's Bradley Whitford's name.
Yeah,
I wrote it down.
Right.
It's
right.
Lawrence. Wow. Just his notes. Coming in handy. He comes in. He hands her a gun, and he says, "They'll be coming for us."
They'll be coming for us.
And it ends.
That last shot of her, there's like sun coming up behind her, and
very symbolic.
It's a fantastic shot. Did you want to? I don't know. How do you want to? Do you want to just give your general impressions of this? I promise to the audience there will be some levity because I have. A few comments, a few notes that I wrote down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you want to just give some general impressions?
I liked it a lot. Not liked it. I, like, wanted to watch it more. I wanted to understand. I'm caught in it between a space where I want to watch it, but I also feel like it's so heavy that I could literally only watch it, like...
Yeah.
A little bit at a time, an episode here, an episode there,
yep.
Before it would cause me anxiety. I mean, like I said, that one scene really did cause me a lot of anxiety. I think the way this was just produced and directed was phenomenal. I mean, there's...
So good.
Just the way scenes were set up, when music was introduced, when there was voiceovers, the juxtapositions of dark and light and color and gray and, you know, it felt like the one house is, there's 1800s vibes and then there's like modern millennial, just really well done. And also I think for the first time on this podcast, This episode is so well done as part of a series, but also has its own storyline. We got was going on so well, and I just...
It was almost like a serial, yeah.
Yeah, and it was just really, really well done. I don't know.
Yeah, a lot surprised me from
it.
Because I the criticism I've heard of it is that it's so slow-moving. And yeah, I do kind of wonder, right, three seasons into this, I know we caught an episode that had a lot of action, but what happened before that? And also, how could there be that many episodes about this, especially given that we saw how efficiently they told a story in one episode?
Mm-hmm.
But alas, I've not seen those, so I don't know. But I kind of get a sense of it. That being said, I thought this episode was phenomenal. A lot surprised me as far as... A lot of the things you mentioned, I'll say the juxtaposition between images and sounds was really interesting. Like there was music being played and it's like, oh yeah, even in sort of a post-apocalyptic or in a dystopia, you'll probably get semblances of older things. In the bar scene, the bar was beautiful, well lit. I told Krista via text that that's the type of place I would like to go, not the type of place content-wise, but just aesthetically. It's very pretty. Nice hotel.
I feel like we've been to places like almost.
We've definitely been to bars that have, like, cool lighting and definitely cool moods.
It's almost like a speakeasy
vibe. Oh, yeah, and especially given what we know about it, that's probably the case. I will say the music in that scene was great. It was by a group I really like called Portishead out of Bristol. So some cool trip hop vibes, which I did not expect out of this show. And then the last, there's a little bit of a visual montage at the end. And it's a song, Cloudbuster by Kate Bush. So, really fantastic music in this show, not something I expected going into it. I thought it was going to feel like complete escapism and not in a good way.
So, David, one thing I do want to talk before we end our episode is about the cast. We've already hit upon some people that were in it. You know, Elizabeth Moss, Bradley Whitford. I think Alexis...
Both West Wing alums.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I forget that every time. Alexis Bledel, I believe, is in it at some point. But, yeah, I have a couple notes on this. So, the first one is Elizabeth Moss. I have had a few people in my life tell me I look like Elizabeth Moss.
I could kind of see it around the eyes, actually. Yeah. Okay. I had never thought about it before, but once you said it, I was thinking, okay, yeah, I can definitely see this.
So that's just a fun fact. Secondly...
That is fun.
So, obviously, Christopher Maloney is in this, and it is so weird to see him play that role. I just want to, you know, comment. Obviously, everyone should know that I'm a big true crime person. I do watch a lot of Law & Order SVU. It's something that's on in the background a lot when I work. So just, like, really cool to see, like, a cast member from a different show that I really like in this. Same thing with Alexis Bledel, even though she was not in this episode, was a big Gilmore Girls fan. So again, another person, and then so odd, but the guy who, in the end, they go to like the Waterfords go to get their child back, and they meet up with that guy, yeah. And he's like, "Actually, you're in Canada." So that actor, and I don't know his name, and I apologize. I should look it up really quick while we're doing this.
Look that up.
He is from another show which I have watched called Parenthood, which also has like a Gilmore Girls tie. Yeah, Sam Yeager.
Right, Lauren Graham, right?
Yes, Lauren Graham. Sam Yeager is his name. He plays in one of the husbands in the show, and love that show, love that character. So
what else is he in?
He is in something else.
The name sounds familiar to me.
Let me look.
I've not seen The Parenthood, though. Is Ray Romano in The Parenthood?
Yes. It's actually a very good show. It touches on some really intense stuff, but it is really, really good. He was in American Sniper.
Nah, I didn't see that.
I don't really know a lot of these films. What other shows was he in? He was in an episode of The West Wing.
Oh, really? Which episode does it say?
It says episode in this White House. It was in 2000.
They all have titles like, I'm not going to go into it. We could do a West Wing episode.
He was also in Law & Order True Crime, The Menendez Murders, which I have not watched.
Oh, man.
He has a very interesting, like, filmography section on Wikipedia, of course, donate. Like, there's a very interesting theme of shows that he is in. Like, very political. What's his first name? Sam, very political and very crime oriented.
Same thing. Am I right?
Yeah.
He was in that movie Hearts War. That was a good one.
Never seen
that. About POWs.
I've seen that. Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of these movies or even really heard about a lot of them.
Yeah. Wow, he's been at this for a long time.
Oh, interesting. He also directed an episode of Parenthood. I'd really like to know which one that is.
That's one thing I like about long-running shows, like when you watch them, yeah. Especially if you binge-watch them, and then you'll be like, directed by, and then it's Bradley Whitford. I'm like, okay. I wonder how they managed to figure out. Yeah.
Interesting. He's from Toledo.
Ohio?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh.
Interesting. Okay.
Go Rockets.
That is, I think, really it for me in the cast. I think, as per usual, we just have a few other, you know, notes, which is a heat thermometer, of course, and then we will we'll spin to see what we're gonna watch next. So
yeah, do you wanna guess mine?
Yeah, let me think about what I think you're going to say, though. Okay, I got it.
Okay.
And also, I'm just gonna add that I feel like I'm going to be within, like, 3 points either way.
Okay.
Ish. Okay, ready?
One, two, three.
84. Damn it. I am way off with you. You liked it a lot more than I thought.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it was good.
It was good.
It's funny, on some of these shows, I feel like, wow, we watched a really pivotal episode, but I have no idea. Maybe all of them are like that.
Well, like we said,
it felt pivotal. You know?
Kind of like what I said earlier, is the cool thing about this show is that we've obviously only watched one episode, and, you know, we hadn't seen it before. And you really, we caught on pretty well. Like, we figured out what was going on. It had its own storyline. It kind of wrapped up, you know, it had a beginning, middle, end. It wasn't all over the place. It was very easy to kind of see what was going on. So I'm curious if all the episodes are like that.
Quick side note.
Yeah.
On our All-American episode, I also wondered if every episode was like that. And I've since started watching the show. And yeah, every episode is kind of like that. Awesome. They all end on like a cliffhanger. Yeah.
Sounds about right for like a teen angsty show.
Yes.
Okay, all right,
what's your, yeah. Do you have it in mind yet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sam Yeager was also in Friday Night Lights. He did a lot of, like, one-episode arcs on shows. Interesting. Okay.
Ready?
Three, two, one. 82.
81. Oh!
Wow.
Okay.
Incredible.
Yeah. Like I said before, I would definitely watch this show again. I want to. It's just not a binge show for me. It's heavy, and as somebody who just, like, already takes in a lot of heavy material with, like, true crime, I would have to pace myself with this. But maybe in the future I will revisit, so. David, do you want to spin the wheel?
Yes, so I added a few more shows. Excellent. I know we really enjoyed our Rhoda episode, so I added some programs from the 70s, 80s, sitcoms, things like that. So we'll see if maybe we get lucky and one of those comes up.
Let's
go ahead.
We've decided that every other episode of the podcast that we'll be doing, a 30-minute episode and then the longer,
hour.
So this one will be a 30-minute episode of And David Spin the Wheel.
Oh, okay. Maud.
I don't know this show.
Okay. It's a spinoff of All in the Family. Not really a spinoff. It wasn't like an established character. They did, you know, I don't know if you've heard the term backdoor pilot before. They'll introduce a character for like one episode. They'll be like, oh, this is so-and-so's cousin. And then they're really good. And then they make a whole show based on that. This was a spinoff sort of All in the Family.
So we're talking 70s, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it may have gone into the 80s, but it definitely started in the 70s. And it stars Bea Arthur, who you may know from Golden Girls. And I think Rue McClanahan is also in that from Golden Girls.
Excellent.
So.
Well, I'm excited.
I've never seen it myself, but yeah, should be a good one.
Hopefully it's just as good as Rhoda. So we really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.